This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. We've told stories on this show before about Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh's antics. He's been a first base coach for a Detroit Tigers spring training game and climbed trees to woo prospects. But ever heard the one about the time he recruited a guy off a Wall Street trading floor? Well, that's not exactly how it happened. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has this story.
My parents met at Michigan as freshmen. My dad actually rigged a Secret Santa to get my mom because he thought she was cute. And the rest was history.
Michael Hirsch was born on January 15th, 1992. He grew up on the outskirts of Chicago near Northwestern University. But his parents made sure that he and his sisters remained loyal to the family team.
It was like we were all brainwashed as little kids almost. I mean, we were all decked out in Michigan gear all the time.
The walls in Hirsch's bedroom were covered with posters of Michigan football players.
I mean, that was probably my first ambitious dream, if you will, my first goal in my life that I could remember was I wanted to play for Michigan. I always dreamed about what it'd be like to look up and see 100,000 people around you and just sing the fight song and everything.
Michael Hirsch was a talented football player. As a 220-pound high school running back, he rushed for 3,375 yards and scored 50 touchdowns. But that wasn't enough to impress the Michigan Wolverines.
I always wished that Michigan would recruit me, but I kind of knew, I had a sense I'm doing okay, but I'm not at that level, that elite level. An analogy that I'll make, I guess, is you thought someone in your high school was the cutest girl in your high school, and you wanted to date her, but it's not like if you didn't have the chance, you felt terrible because, a thousand other people couldn't date her too.
If he couldn't date the cutest girl, Hirsch figured he'd go for the nerdiest. He decided he'd use football to try to get into a good college.
And I found this dream school with a great football program in Harvard, and so I committed there.
So in the fall of 2010, Hirsch moved into his freshman dorm. Full disclosure, Hirsch and I went to Harvard at the same time, but we didn't know each other because he was way cooler than me. Anyways, Hirsch played on the JV team as a freshman. He had added 10 pounds since his high school days, so he started running less and blocking more. In March, spring practice began.
And I just felt like I had a cold that I couldn't shake, and you're working really hard because you have those 6 a.m. workouts every day. I thought maybe I was run down, so I just tried to rest. And you know what? I couldn't shake it, and I thought maybe I have some allergies or something.
But he didn't worry about it too much. He finished out the year and went home for the summer.
My mom's like, your voice sounds a little different and you still don't feel good. Let's start to go to some doctors and figure this out. So then I saw, 15 doctors. They kept putting me on different antibiotics. I'd try this for a little bit. I'd try that. And my health just kept getting worse. My ears were sore. My knees were sore. My throat hurt all the time. Sometimes there'd be blood in my spit. And it was kind of progressing quickly.
He saw even more doctors. Finally, he found an allergist who called it. Hirsch had Wegener's granulomatosis. It's a rare autoimmune disease that causes blood vessels to become inflamed. Untreated, it can lead to organ failure and eventually death.
I was playing D1 football a month ago, and then suddenly I'm just sitting in a hospital bed. And I remember all these doctors kept coming in and out, and I'm hooked up to different things. It was this is actually something that's pretty serious.
The doctors put Hirsch on a plan. Every week, he'd inject himself in the leg with a drug to reduce inflammation. He would also need to visit a doctor regularly for blood tests and other treatments. Luckily, he connected with a top rheumatologist at a hospital just 3 subway stops from Harvard's campus, so Hirsch could go back for a sophomore year while he underwent treatment. But football?
I mentioned it to a doctor, and he said, oh, no, you're not going to be able to play any sport, not to mention a contact sport. That was absolutely a tough moment for me, just because all my best friends were on the team. I was so excited to go back and compete and be with them, and suddenly that was taken away. And there was certainly a little bit of an empty feeling there, what next? What am I going to do?
During the fall of his sophomore year, Hirsch held out hope that he'd someday be able to rejoin the team. But as his recovery dragged on, he needed blood infusions, and then he got tubes put in his ears, and then he underwent trachea surgery. He came to accept that he was never going to be able to suit up for the varsity. He could have found something else to do, play video games all the time, or actually do all the reading for class, or, hang out with me on the school newspaper. But he decided that he'd made a 4-year commitment to the team. So if he couldn't play, he'd be a manager. So the guy who scored 50 touchdowns in high school spent his sophomore, junior, and senior years carrying water, setting up cones, and filming practices.
So it certainly was a sense of loss. And I continued to dream about playing football all the time after that. And I'd wake up and be like, dang, like that's a dream now.
By his senior year, Hirsch was in remission and in good health. He graduated in May 2014, right on schedule, and landed a job on Wall Street as an analyst for Citigroup. And Hirsch was happy, or at least as happy as a first-year Wall Street analyst can be. But he kept having those dreams about football.
Probably every 2 weeks, I'd have a dream. I was in high school playing, or college playing. I got one more year, one more chance. And I'd always wake up, and it was like a very bittersweet dream to have because I didn't have that.
That's when Michael Hirsch got a pretty wild idea. Since he had only played one season for Harvard's JV team, he still had college eligibility. If he could get the okay from his doctors and the NCAA, and if he could get into a master's program somewhere, he could join a football team as a graduate student. And since he was already dreaming, Michael Hirsch decided he'd go with the biggest dream he'd ever had. He was going to try to play football for the Michigan Wolverines. The first steps were getting into playing shape and into business school. So every day, Hirsch worked on Wall Street from 6 a.m. to after 6 p.m. Then he'd go to the gym, and after that, he'd study for the GMAT before bed. Eventually, his coworkers started asking questions.
They're looking at me like, why are you eating all that protein on the desk at work? Like, why are you 20 pounds bigger now? Like, what's going on, dude? Like, I remember, you know, one of my coworkers said, you know, what are you training for, dude? Like, you're an adult. It's, like, not a good look to just bulk up like that.
Hirsch didn't say anything about his plan because, well, he didn't want people to think he was crazy. So he kept his scheme a secret, and eventually he got the GMAT score he needed for Michigan's business school. And he connected with one of the football coaches. He invited Hirsch to come visit the campus on the same weekend as potential walk-ons.
My parents met me in Ann Arbor. I flew from New York for the day, and they wanted to come on the visit with me. And I was like, I'm not 18 years old. You guys can't, like, come on the visit with me. I'm 23. I have to have this adult persona that's, like, part of the sell that I'm trying to show here to join the team.
Whether it was his adult persona or his backstory or the fact that Michigan was looking for some depth at fullback, the coaches told Hirsch he'd have a spot on the team. All he had to do now was get cleared by his doctors and present his case to the NCAA. So back in New York, Hirsch spent his days calling hedge funds and clients and secretly emailing doctors and NCAA officials from his cell phone. First, the doctor said okay. And then one day, while Hirsch was at work, he missed a call from an Ann Arbor number.
This was like 5 o'clock on a Tuesday on the trading floor. I ran to like a side meeting room. I listened to the voicemail, and I still have it saved. And, you know, I said, hey, Mike, this is Coach Harbaugh. I've got some great news for you. And at that point, my heart just, like, jumped out of my chest. Like, I didn't even listen to the rest of the message. And I called him back, and he let me know that I had won my case. I had earned eligibility, and I was going to be able to join the team. And it was just one of the happiest moments of my life.
And in what's likely a first for Wall Street, an analyst was granted a one-year sabbatical to go play college football. Last summer, Michael Hirsch showed up at training camp. He was 24 years old and working on a master's in management. But on the football team, he was a rookie. So he trained and ate meals with the 18-year-old freshman. They taught him about rappers he'd never heard of and gave him some nicknames. Old man, dad, grandpa. Michael Hirsch was thrilled.
Welcome back to the University of Michigan on just a perfect September afternoon.
And on September 3rd, 2016, in Ann Arbor, Michigan opened its season against Hawaii in front of 110,000 fans. Hirsch knew he was way down the depth chart and unlikely to play. But then Michigan started winning, by a lot.
I'm like running the mental math, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, where the threshold is for they're going to start to throw in the second team guys and the third team guys. I just wanted to get on the field once, like play one actual play.
At halftime, Michigan was up 35-0. Hirsch's teammates started getting excited for him.
You know, they're looking at me, like raising their eyebrows, like, hey, Hirsch, like it could happen, dude. Like this could be it. I'm just like, I'm rooting for us like even harder than I ever had before.
Then Michigan went up 40 points, then 50 points. One of the coaches told Hirsch to start getting ready.
At that point, you're standing around for like 2.5 hours. I'm like, oh my goodness, I better like warm my legs up and get ready to go out there. And so a lot of anxiety, you know, standing right there next to the coach on the side. And then finally, he said, Hirsch, hop in there. So then it all like happened super fast. And on one hand, I'm like, holy cow, I did it. Like I'm registering a play for Michigan. And I go in the huddle and Shane Morris is playing quarterback. I remember when he committed to Michigan. I'm that big of a fan. So I've been a fan of this guy and all the guys in the huddle my whole life. And now I'm out there in the big house playing with them. And suddenly the huddle is broken. I'm like, oh my God, like there's a play. I have to do it now.
It was third down with 4 yards to go. Michigan called a pass play. Hirsch's job was to run to the left and look for the ball. He was open. Morris lofted a pass over a defender.
Luckily, I didn't have much time to think about it because I definitely would have dropped it if I had overthought it, which would have been sad, right? Like his big moment, and then he just drops it. But I grabbed it.
Complete pass from Morris out in the flat, and we'll find
I ran, and I just tried to like run into someone, try to run someone over. I probably could have went further, but I kind of ran right to the first guy I saw.
Hirsch picked up 15 yards in a first down.
For an old man, 24-year-old, who was sitting at a desk for a long time, I was happy about it. And it was, I had a stat, and that's pretty cool, right? Like, I get to be in the Michigan records or whatever, if anyone's looking at who, like, the worst fullback is with the worst catch ever. Like, there I am.
That ended up being Hirsch's lone catch of the season. He hardly played after that game. But Hirsch says he couldn't have been happier watching from the sidelines as a Michigan Wolverine for the 2016 season. In September, he'll return to his job at City. Michael Hirsch's football career is now officially over, and he's finally okay with that.
I haven't had a dream about football since. I haven't had a single time where I've dreamt about, you know, oh, one more chance, more possibility. So I'm sleeping well at night.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
Plenty of athletes are confident. Sometimes they're ridiculously confident.
I'm pretty much the best there is. Like, there doesn't get any better than this, you know?
Meet Sean Jaster, world's best inner tube intramural water polo player, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Benny Broombaugh left the following review on iTunes. I listen to this show weekly and think it has some of the best sports radio journalism. I get to hear truly inspiring stories that ignite my love for sports. I wish it aired twice a week. Thanks, Benny Broombaugh, but twice a week? I need a nap just thinking about it. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's Final Four weekend, and this year's spectacle is being held in Arizona, more specifically at the University of Phoenix Stadium, typically the home of the NFL's Arizona Cardinals. And one of this week's guests has some feelings about that venue. The guests are Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay and Washington Post's Cindy Boren. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Jason, I understand that you are not entirely delighted by the venue that I previously mentioned.
No, I'm out of my mind, Bill. I'm just... I'm so sick and tired of this ritual. Now, this is almost 40 years that the NCAA has been hosting its Final Four in this gargantuan stadium. It's been in every dome imaginable. Domes that don't even exist. King Dome, Metrodome. We have it in the University of Phoenix. Some 80,000 people, roughly, will be showing up to watch the Final Four, Bill. And you know what about 60,000 of them will be doing? Watching it on a jumbotron because they can barely see the court. I don't mean to surprise you and shock you guys here, but it's kind of dictated by money.
That is shocking. Absolutely shocking.
It turns out that college sports are interested in making money. I researched this. And the reason they make this move, of course, is because they can sell a lot more tickets. At a certain point, you start to diminish the experience. And basketball, you know, I have to say a reader wrote this to me, and I'm going to steal it and take credit for it. But basketball is one of those things, almost like, you know, seeing a concert. The smaller the room, the better and more memorable the experience.
I'm going to have to argue with Mr. Cranky Pants. that's what we're going to call you now. No, I take your point about basketball. I think it is one of those things that is best enjoyed in a small, dank, dingy dungeon of a gym. You know, the problem is the ship has left the harbor. Unless you can somehow turn back the clock or shrink down the NCAA, but I'm not seeing anything in sports that's shrinking right now.
Well, weirdly enough, the NBA did. The NBA experimented with giant arenas for its All-Star game, and they decided that they didn't like it. And, you know, this year, weirdly enough, they had their All-Star game in New Orleans right next to the Superdome. I mean, they could have filled the Superdome. You don't think 70,000 people want to go see the NBA All-Star game, but they prefer
the smaller
place.
No, I don't. I really don't. I mean,
really?
Did you see the NBA All-Star game? How many points were scored in the NBA All-Star
game? I think the final score was 700 to 699.
We did do a story years ago about the game that was held in the Astrodome, the NCAA Final Four held in the Astrodome, and the people who were sitting on the floor needed periscopes to see the game, and the people who were sitting in the cheap seats needed telescopes to see the game. So I can see your point. On the other hand, why does it matter for money? Because it's all about TV rights, isn't it? Isn't that where all the money comes from, advertising on TV for the NCAA Final Four?
Well, you're exactly right, Bill. I mean, the driver of the economics of all this is television. It's a multi-billion dollar deal for the rights to the Final Four and to March Madness as an entity. It's hard to walk it back. I agree with Cindy entirely that, you know, the horse is out of the barn and that it's very hard to dial these things back. But I would say that, weirdly enough, there's a school of thought out there that thinks that the way to go with stadium construction now is smaller, smaller, smaller. The San Diego Chargers. Now, I'm not comparing the appeal of the San Diego Chargers
that's a good thing.
To a Final Four. But they're going to be playing in the Home Depot Center in L.A. next season. It's going to be 30,000-some-odd seats. I know that means much more expensive tickets, but hey, I can't afford those tickets as it is right now.
All right, it's my turn, and money is once again going to be in the discussion. John Calipari is paid $7.5 million a year to coach the men's basketball team at the University of Kentucky, and he, like 38 other basketball or football coaches, is the most lavishly compensated person in his state working for a public entity. This is not a new circumstance, of course, but the Final Four gives me a good occasion to bring it up again. And here's my question. Is this phenomenon merely the rational end of the working of market forces? That is, by definition, is Coach Calipari paid precisely what he's worth? Or is it flat out nuts to pay somebody $7.4 million to coach a basketball team?
Well, I think it's both, actually. I think he's worth, nobody's worth that kind of money, but he's worth a lot of money. He's a very good coach. We have a story on the Post website right now about the University of Central Florida, which is building an athletic facility. I think it's a $25 million bunch of upgrades. It's going to be like a tropical playground. They're putting in a lazy river with a miniature golf course.
For that money, they should get an energetic river.
Phil, this is an arms race now.
Interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go down to the University of Florida, where I went to a conference of sports economists called the NCAA Cartel. And this very issue came up. And what was really interesting to hear from these economists was that they don't feel like it's market forces that are driving these crazy salaries. $7.5 million for Calipari. I think Jim Harbaugh is up to $9 million at the University of Michigan. What it actually indicates, what these economists feel it indicates, is that there's just such a surplus of money that's created by these top programs that they have to spend it somewhere. They're spending it on things like $7.5 million coaches and lazy rivers. What are they not spending it on? They're not spending it on the athletes, the people who are actually out there competing day in, day out, and making the compelling theater that is college sports.
Cindy, you're up.
I'm going to talk about Draymond Green. He did a nice thing the other night. He talked about the Oakland Raiders who are moving to Las Vegas. You might have heard something about that. And he sympathized with the poor, poor Raider fans who are being deserted. Not only deserted, but they are now expected for the next 3 years until their stadium in Vegas is ready to turn up and cheer, cheer, cheer for the Raiders in Oakland. And, you know, that's ugly. It's awkward. And give Draymond Green credit for feeling that pain. You know, he said, there's no way I'd attend a game for the next 3 years. It's ridiculous. No way I'd pay. Unfortunately, there's one little thing that Draymond Green was forgetting. He plays for the Golden State Warriors, who play in Oakland and are, yes, leaving in another few years for San Francisco.
Yeah, but
they got
to just across the bay. It's not very far.
It is.
It's not like going to Las Vegas.
No, and, you know, in fairness to him, at least you will be able to see Oakland from their new arena. Unlike, you know, Vegas, you're going to need a telescope to see Oakland.
Cindy, I don't want to brag here, but you got to speak to Draymond Green. This week I spoke to Wayne Newton. And Wayne Newton thinks the Las Vegas Raiders are a great idea. I'm just telling you right now that Mr. Las Vegas has no problem whatsoever with the Oakland Raiders making their way to the desert. But this whole construct that you talk about and that Draymond talked about, this idea of the zombie seasons that the Raiders are going to be playing by the bay for the next couple of years, it is a really bizarre situation. What do you do if you are a fan who has, you know, lived and died with this team for a number of years? Let's not forget these guys escaped to L.A. for 13 seasons, so it's not like there's without precedent here. But it is a weird thing, right? Should they be going out and maybe like setting up something temporary in Las Vegas for a couple seasons before they move into their giant $2 billion fancy pants stadium? I don't know. It's you have to feel for this very tormented fan base. And the weirdest part of all, this is a really good team. Usually when these teams go on the road, they're bad and no one wants them. And it's kind of like, good riddance, you made me sad anyway. The Raiders were a fabulous AFC team last year. They could be a Super Bowl contender this season. It's a very bizarre circumstance.
Who knew Wayne Newton was still alive?
I wasn't going to say that.
I'm thrilled.
Just 75. Come on, guys. Doing a show a night at the Bally's.
Anyway, my thoughts regarding the Raiders' move, I'm fine. They can move wherever they want. But it's the speculation about the next move that has me worried, because there is a lot of talk about the NFL putting a team in London, and that bothers me a lot. First of all, because I really like London, and secondly, because philosophically, should we really be inflicting football on other countries? I don't think we should.
What, they have soccer. They don't need football.
Exactly. They have no, they have football. They don't need football.
No, that's true. They don't need our football. I know lots of people in England who actually love the NFL. If they want a team over there, why not give them, you know, say goodbye to Jacksonville, Jaguars, you're heading to London.
Oh,
what I think it's unfortunate that we sort of give them our refuse, you know?
Right, yeah.
But
or scraps.
I would just be a little broader in my definition of refuse, that's all. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Washington Post's Cindy Bourne and the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Sports fans across the country will be tuning into the men's and women's NCAA Final Fours this weekend. They're quite possibly the biggest spectacles in college sports, so we here at Only a Game have decided to bring you a story from lower down the college sports ranks. Much lower down. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
I've met plenty of confident athletes in my day, but I've never met an athlete quite as cocky as Sean Jaster.
I'm pretty much the best there is. There doesn't get any better than this, you know? I'm patting myself on the back right now. I'm really good at this.
Oh, my God.
Sean and his friend Aaron Harris are intramural athletes at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Intramural sports don't offer any of the perks enjoyed by the players in this weekend's Final Fours. There are no scholarships, no free food, no coaches, no practices, no uniforms, and almost no fans. Often, the winners receive nothing more than championship t-shirts.
Intramural sports are like the lowest level of the sports. So it's like the bottom of the barrel.
And this sport specifically is the lowest of the low, because no one played inner tube water polo in high school.
Yeah, no, nobody cares about inner tube intramural water polo.
Yep, inner tube intramural water polo. It's played on college campuses from Brigham Young to Indiana University to the University of New Hampshire. Sean Jaster and Aaron Harris have been really successful at inner tube intramural water polo, in part due to Aaron's leadership.
Aaron likes to create plays, and we humor him.
Occasionally, when things line up just right, we will say, okay, time for the flying V. We'll pull everybody off and just line up a V like you'd see in the Mighty Ducks.
Ducks stick together, right?
Yeah!
So let's see it. Show me the flying V.
All right.
Let's get a line change.
Wait, why are college athletes talking about a movie that was made in 1992?
We just aged ourselves referring to the Mighty Ducks.
Sean and Aaron are a bit older than your average college athlete, but they just can't seem to give up the sport they love. It all started back when they were sophomores, or maybe they were juniors. No one can quite remember anymore. Aaron Harris was working in the intramural sports office, and he organized a meeting to connect potential inner tube intramural water polo players with potential inner tube intramural water polo teams. Sean Jaster had just returned to Colorado State after a year away with AmeriCorps. While he was gone, his club water polo, that's real water polo, team had disbanded, and most of his friends had graduated. So
Sean and this other guy named Steve showed up, and they were the only two there, if I recall.
I walk in the door, and there's Aaron, and he's like,
yeah, you guys can join my team, sure. You know, we need a couple extra players.
He didn't realize that he was getting a real water polo offensive player, so it was kind of a nice pick for him.
Yeah.
Inner tube water polo doesn't seem to have a whole lot in common with regular water polo, except for the goals on either side of the pool.
We are all in inner tubes. There's a goalie who's in an inner tube as well. You put your feet on the side of the wall, and they blow the whistle, and then everyone does a mad dash for the center of the pool where the refs throw the ball. And if there's a defender on you, you can only have the ball for 5 seconds. So the refs will call out, you know, 5, 4, 3, and once you get to one, then you have to pass it or shoot it.
Right from the outset, Aaron and Sean were good, really good.
And I remember we had this pretty heated rivalry with one of the fraternities. What were they called?
The Pikes.
The Pikes, yeah.
There was a championship game we played against them the first year, and we were shorthanded. And I remember them just swearing up and down the pool, like, how are they beating us? We have more players than they do. And I was just like, I don't know.
Yeah, they just, like, throw me the ball, and I would score at will.
When Sean and Aaron graduated, it might have been a logical time for them to hang up their swimming trunks, but they didn't quit. They found out about a little-known rule that allows CSU staff and alumni to participate in intramural sports.
We're like, well, they'll let us keep playing if we just keep paying our memberships, so we kept playing.
Aaron and Sean play twice a year, with a co-ed team in the fall and a men's team in the spring. At first, they were joined by friends who were attending the vet school at CSU.
We were holding on to this idea that, like, oh, well, we still have graduate students on our team. That's how we could, like, reconcile in our heads that it was okay for us to be playing undergraduate students in this game. And then as they started graduating and going off and being actual adults, we decided we did not want to do that. Like, I mean, every year, like, I get a text or a phone call from Aaron, like, hey, you want to play this year? Yep, I want to play.
Sean and Aaron didn't quit when they settled down and started families of their own. When two of their teammates from the co-ed team fell in love with each other and decided to get married, Aaron officiated the ceremony. They didn't quit when a friend and teammate died in a car accident late in the season. They won the finals in his honor and brought his championship T-shirt to the funeral. Now Aaron and Sean are 36. They've been playing inner tube intramural water polo at Colorado State for 15 years. These days, when they line up in their inner tubes for the start of a game, they don't have much in common with the players floating on the other side of the pool.
Last season in the championship game, I looked at the team we were playing. Every single one of them had a six-pack. Every single person on our team had just this huge gut, just of the mid-30s dad bod. I'm like, whew, we are out of shape.
We're playing against these teams. Like, our body mass index of our team is probably 3 times that of the teams we're playing. Like, our age, I'm 36 years old, and most of the kids we're playing are, like, 19. Most of us have kids. We're, like, married. I'm divorced even, you know. So, like, our life experience is so different, yet we are still signing up every year for inner tube, intramural water polo.
Any idea how many championships you guys have at this point?
20-ish.
That's most of them.
Yeah. Like, if there were 30 total championships to be won in the last 15 years, we'd probably have 20 of them.
Yeah.
Don't you guys feel bad about that?
I kind of do. I really kind of do. Like, and at the same time, I really like it. I don't know. It's an ethical dilemma.
Sean Jaster might feel bad about his 15-year inner tube intramural water polo dynasty, but that doesn't mean he's ready to quit. He and Aaron Harris have a moment in mind for when they'll finally walk away from their inner tubes, and it's not coming anytime soon.
Sean and I have had a joke. He's got two daughters, and I will soon have two daughters. Maybe we'll keep playing until our daughters are playing with us.
Let's see. The youngest hasn't been born yet, so that means they just need to hang on for another 18, 19 years? For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Sports writer Scott Rabb was penning a nice book about LeBron James, and then LeBron defected to Miami.
When he walked away from Cleveland without a ring and with that hour-long special, then it became a different kind of book, kind of written out of cumulative rage.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Leo Ferris helped create the NBA and basketball shot clock, so why don't more people remember his name? That's next week on Only a Game. Now for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
After Kentucky lost to North Carolina in Sunday's Elite Eight men's game, Kentucky coach John Calipari had something to say about the officiating, and I guess Kentucky fans did as well.
Yeah, and Kentucky fans are disgracing themselves at a pretty rapid pace here. A referee named John Higgins, who worked the game, not only did they work their internet magic trying to destroy his roofing business, he got death threats and stuff, and John Calipari should apologize to his family immediately and do something about this.
Attendance was way down in this year's women's NCAA regionals, something like 50% lower than it was 3 years ago. Have you any sense of why this has happened?
Except they keep putting them at neutral sites in huge buildings. And I don't have a problem with them, given the size of arenas these days, I don't have a problem with them going to campus sites. Mm. I mean, the coaches will complain, but I don't care about that. So,
on Thursday, the North Carolina legislature voted to repeal the controversial HB 2 bathroom bill after months of pressure from the NCAA, which had threatened not to hold events in North Carolina. Does this fix everything?
No, because it's not a compromise and it doesn't fix the bill. What it does is try to put a little gloss on it so the NCAA won't pull its events for 4 years. The discriminatory aspects of HB 2 are still there. They've just been subcontracted to cities and towns. And this particular compromise in practice will exist only at the sufferance of the North Carolina legislature, which collectively is out of its mind. So, no, if the NCAA buys this, the NCAA is even dumber than I thought it was.
Well, then that's the next question. Right. Will the NCAA buy this, or will they recognize it as fraudulent?
I think they want to buy it. If they do buy it, they're going to get even more heat than they think they're going to get.
Major League Baseball season begins this weekend.
Yay!
To paraphrase a popular rhetorical question normally associated with another sport, are you ready for some baseball?
I guess, yeah. I'm ready for the concept of a defending world champion Chicago Cubs.
I love it. I love it. Because this is the time of year for predictions. So who do you suppose the Cubs will play in the World Series this year?
Well, now that the respective voodoo that they do so well is gone, I think we can safely have a Cubs-Red Sox World Series without a meteor plunging to Earth before the first pitch of Game 7.
President Trump has turned down an invitation to throw out the first pitch when the Washington Nationals open their season against the Miami Marlins on Monday. Scheduling conflict, he says. Golf?
Who knows? All right, multiple choice question for our audience. One, he doesn't throw the ball very well.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he doesn't want to appear and get booed by 70,000 people. Or three, the Nationals couldn't meet his price.
That could be. It could be all of the above.
It actually could be. Or D, all of the above.
You know, there are people who really object when politicians come out at ball games to throw out the first pitch and do things like that. They don't think that should happen. I think it should happen because when I can see those guys out on the ball field, I know they're not doing anything mischievous somewhere else.
That's exactly right.
I'm very happy to see them out
there.
That's
exactly right. And, of course, the first president to throw out the first pitch was noted physical fitness expert William Howard Taft.
The U.S. women's hockey team got a new deal this week, Charlie. What are the key points of that deal, and what does it mean for the team as they play in the World Championships?
You know, more money, more money, more money, more player safety, more player insurance. But the most impressive thing to me about this, and this is such a hockey thing, Bill, is that the women's hockey team stuck together and fought a labor action. And USA Hockey tried to hire scabs, and they couldn't find any.
Yeah, all the way down to the high school
that
level.
That is such a hockey thing.
It's great. It's great. Money has begun to change hands, Charlie, in connection with the NFL's billion-dollar concussion settlement. So that's a good thing, right?
No, it's a mess. And it's a lot of money. And plaintiffs are fighting with their lawyers, and lawyers are fighting with other lawyers.
And lawyers are getting the money.
Lawyers are getting the money, and lawyers are stealing clients from other. It's just a disaster. I don't know that it's possible because I'm not a lawyer, but I only play one here on Only a Game. But this calls out for some kind of special master to come here and just try to make some order out of this, because it's so disgusting what happened to the players that those players should be allowed the dignity of having the settlement handled in a decent way.
On Monday, NFL owners approved the move of the Oakland Raiders to Las Vegas. The Raiders announced they'd play two, maybe even three more seasons in Oakland before the move. And then Scott McKibben, the executive director of the Oakland Alameda Coliseum Authority, said, "I'll be the judge of that."
Yes!
Are we looking at a team that's going to be playing all its games on the road until the Vegas move takes place?
Well, to be fair, McKibben says there's no way they're going to play in 2019. Having watched the Oakland fans over 50 years, I am not an adherent to the cooler heads prevailing in regards to this. This will only give the Oakland fans two more years to get even crazier and even angrier about this.
These are people who show up at football games dressed like extras from Mad Max.
Exactly, and maybe not extras.
Maybe
the leads.
Right.
But and if you recall, the last year of the Cleveland Browns in Cleveland, when the fans knew the team was leaving, they ended up with people ripping out the seats in the stadium and throwing them onto the field.
Yep.
And believe me, the people in Cleveland are a preschool compared to the Raiders fans.
They didn't want souvenirs. They wanted missiles.
That's right.
Right. All right. It's time to celebrate National Hockey League ref Wes McCauley, who I learned this week has a flair for the dramatic when he switches on his microphone during games in order to make announcements. Let's listen to him.
After reviewing the play, the call on the ice stands. We got a goal!
And I love this announcement of matching fighting penalties from a recent Bruins-Canadiens game.
Five for Montreal, number 47 for Boston. Both guys, 5 minutes each for fighting!
I'm not usually in favor of game officials becoming the show, but this guy makes a case for it.
That is absolutely fabulous. And how did this guy get away from the WWE?
That's a great question.
You know?
That's a great question. Finally, Charlie,
an
airport in Portugal has been named after soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo, and the facility has been graced with a bust of Mr. Ronaldo as a terrifying alien. I can't look at this for more than a few seconds because I'm afraid I would turn to stone.
As the unfortunate victim of a letterpress accident, the hair is going up in one direction, the eyes are sliding toward each other.
If they name an airport after you, do you get to say, "Thank you very much, but please throw a towel over that bust"?
Please put my initials on this airport and give this thing to American International Pictures.
You can find Charlie Pierce's sports writing in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I think as a young boy, I kind of went dark. My love for Cleveland sports teams actually outweighed my love for anything else in my life.
That's Scott Rabb. His love for Cleveland's teams was enduring. It endured the Rabb family's move from Cleveland to California in 1960. It was fueled, perhaps jet-fueled, by one of his heroes, Jim Brown, who led the Browns to the NFL championship in 1964.
Cleveland was still a thriving metropolis, certainly nobody's idea of a punchline city in the early 1960s, and the Browns were a landmark NFL franchise, not the clown car that they've become.
Following that championship, Rabb's love for Cleveland sports teams endured a great many disappointments involving not only the Browns, but the Indians and the Cavaliers. And then...
the answer to the question everybody wants to know. LeBron, what's your decision?
This fall, man, this is very tough. And this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
On July 8th, 2010, when LeBron James announced in a preposterously silly spectacle on national television that after seven championship-free years with the Cavaliers, he was moving on, Rabb's love morphed into epithet-fueled fury.
he'd been working on a book about the Cavaliers and James.
When he walked away from Cleveland without a ring and with that hour-long special, then it became a different kind of book, kind of written out of cumulative rage.
Rabb titled the book The Whore of Akron.
Yes, it was angry and vulgar. The Whore of Akron certainly went against my agent's advice, which is based on the fact that a lot of books are sold at big box stores like Costco, and they're not necessarily going to put out stacks of books with the word whore in the title so that, you know, young folks with their parents shopping can say, what does that word mean?
For Rabb, James came to embody not only the many disappointments Cleveland fans had suffered, but the city's fall from whatever grace it could claim when its citizens were employed to its rusty, diminished present. Rabb wrote that Cleveland needed saving and that LeBron James was the man for the job.
I wanted him to be our Moses, and I was absolutely open about that metaphor in The Whore of Akron.
After playing for two championship teams in Miami, LeBron James surprised Scott Rabb. He decided to return to the Cavaliers. The bad blood between ownership and prodigal player dried up and blew away on a breeze off the Cuyahoga River. Rabb wasn't so fortunate.
Once LeBron returned, I hoped for a chance to, if not apologize, at least show up and apologize, frankly. You know, I reached out to people in public relations, people who've worked with him, and never even received a reply. And I totally understand you write a book like that about a guy, and there may be no coming back.
No coming back might have provided an appropriate final summation of Rabb's relationship to LeBron, the Cavaliers, and even the city of Cleveland if Rabb hadn't continued to be not only a fan, but a writer driven by curiosity about where the story might go next. He hoped, like everybody rooting for Cleveland, that the return of LeBron James for the 2014-15 season would produce a championship. Immediately. It didn't. But it almost did. The Cavs lost in the finals to the Golden State Warriors, but that meant they were close enough for Scott Rabb to regard LeBron James more charitably. And there was more to it than that. James established college scholarships for 1,000 Akron third graders who'd promised to stay in school. He sent cupcakes to neighbors inconvenienced by the media trucks he'd attracted.
When LeBron came back, he talked about a calling beyond basketball. So when he came back, I really felt hope had returned. I unfairly slagged him for not being Moses, and guess what? He comes back as sort of a Moses figure.
Rabb was a writer deep into a story that might turn out to have a terrific ending. How could he quit? Never mind that he couldn't get a press credential. Never mind that he was living in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, rather than Cleveland. He was determined to follow the Cavs as they tried, under the leadership of LeBron James, to take that final step. And Rabb was compelled to do that by something more potent than mere fandom. He regretted that he'd said awful things about a basketball player who was also, among other things, a father. Because, as a father himself, Rabb so fervently valued his relationship with his own 17-year-old son. Rabb's father had suffered from bipolar disorder, and the grandparents who helped raise him were prone to knocking each other around. Rabb decided he'd see as many Cavaliers games as possible, no matter that it meant driving from New Jersey to Ohio a lot, and he asked his son to come along.
The one through line of our relationship, me and my boy, turned out to be Cleveland sports, and so the opportunity just to travel with him, just hitting the road. I drove out with my father before. When we moved to Los Angeles from Cleveland in 1960, we drove Route 66 most of the way once we caught it in Illinois. And that, for me, became the entirety of my childhood memory of being with my dad.
Rabb was determined to be a better father than his father had been. And so for him, the 2015-16 Cavaliers season had become doubly significant. He would be making amends for what he'd said about LeBron James, insofar as that could be done, and he'd be bonding with the son who'd be leaving home soon for college and the world beyond. But there was a complication. Scott Rabb saw no reason to let anything get in the way of regular trips to Cleveland, but his son had responsibilities.
He's just a good guy. My wife and I were saying last night he's studying for a physics and calc test. We have never had to say, have you done your homework? So when it came time to go, you know, if we stay an extra day, we can see the Browns. He was like, I got to get back. I have my AP exams, whatever it was. And, you know, he's like an alien life form to me in that way. That at the age of 17 or 18, I was, you know, in the sullen loners club, to the extent there was such a club,
Actually, I was the sullen loners club.
Rab understood the risks in the commitment he and his son were making. Did further heartbreak loom? The return of LeBron James to the Cavaliers was one thing. Actually bringing a championship to the city was something else entirely. Rab was aware of the potential for failure on the part of the team. It's in Cleveland, but...
It's over! It's over! Cleveland is a city of champions once again! The Cavaliers are NBA champions!
The Cavaliers not only won the 2016 NBA championship, they won it after falling behind in the finals 3-1 to the favored Warriors. Was Cleveland redeemed? It felt that way, at least to Scott Rabb.
With my son on Father's Day in a sports bar in Cleveland watching on TV, the emotions were overwhelming in the best possible way. It still feels great. I had to go back and rewatch and pay special attention to the last couple of minutes of Game 7. I have never seen that sequence without choking up. I'm absolutely thrilled about it.
Thrilled and relieved. Because when LeBron and Cleveland won, Rab could step to the shelf in his study and put another book beside the Whore of Akron. The new book would be about a winner, and Rab would be proud to have his kid check it out. And the book's title is You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City.
You know, I've gotten some blowback from people telling me how pretentious and delusional I must be, as if that's a serious title. So just for the record, I did nothing to help LeBron James. I don't necessarily think Cleveland needed saving anyway. I'm just a guy who's along for the ride trying to have a few laughs, figure out a few things, and hopefully entertain and delight a reader.
Sure, that's easy for Scott Rabb to say now. Cleveland won. Only a Game is produced by Karen Gibbon, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word comes from Scott Rabb, Cleveland sports fan, but not that kind of Cleveland sports fan.
I wasn't just one of those guys who would wind up, you know, shirtless in December with the team's logo painted on me.
Yeah, me neither, Scott, unless somebody found the pictures of a guy who... Looks like me. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.